Good afternoon, everybody. Does everybody have a copy of the sutta? It's 89 and it's up here. I guess just a few comments before I get started. If you've read it before, you probably noticed that it's pretty straightforward sutras. Not a whole lot to add in terms of comments. Also, not very kind of complicated vocabularies or any kind of subtle concepts. But it deals with kind of faith, gratitude, and respect. Kind of very basic qualities of any spiritual path. I don't know, it's one of my favorites, so I just like reading it. So that's why we're doing this. Okay? Also, if you read the notes to it, there are some political happenings in the background, but it doesn't really affect the understanding of the sutta at all. So we'll see whether we'll include that in the commentary or not. Okay? Any questions to begin with? No? Okay, we'll start. Okay. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at a town of the Sakyans named Metalumpa. Now on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had arrived at Nagaraka for some business or other. Then he addressed Dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared, let us go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot. Yes, Dayadiga replied. When the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, Sire, the state carriages are ready for you. Now is the time to do as you think fit. So as you know, the good first page, a page and a half, is just setting up the story of, you know, King Pasenadi going to visit the Buddha, and then the action starts, okay? Then King Pasenadi mounted a state carriage and accompanied by other carriages. He drove out from Nagaraka with a full pomp of royalty and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages and then dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. As he walked and wandered in the park for exercise, King Pasenadi saw roots of trees that were lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. The sight of these reminded him of the Blessed One thus. These roots of trees are lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat, like the places we used to pay respect to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Then he told Digga what he had thought and asked, where is he living now, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened? Okay, first comment. You notice, even the Buddha, who's enlightened, very pure mind, he still lives in very secluded, very remote places, very peaceful and quiet places. So it's also a good kind of indication that in terms of, you know, obviously the mind is a forerunner and our internal state is more important, our states of mind is more important, but the external has a lot to do with it. So in order to, for the mind to come to peaceful, to become peaceful, we have to kind of simplify our life, live in peaceful places, right? Quiet places, away from activity, reduce our own busy life. So it's just to start off with, you know, if you want a peaceful mind, peaceful lifestyle, then kind of simplify, live away from kind of center of activities, quiet places. Okay. There is thy or town, the Sakyans and named Metalumpa, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there. How far is it from Nagaraka to Metalumpa? It is not far, sire, 3 leagues. And I think in the notes it says about 20 miles, which is about 26 kilometers or something, give or take. Okay, there is still daylight, enough to go there. Then, dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared. Let us go and see the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Yes, sire, he replied. When the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, Sire, the state carriages are ready for you. Now is the time to do as you think fit. Then King Pasenadi mounted the state carriage and accompanied by other carriages, set out from Nagaraka towards the Sakya town of Metalumpa. He arrived there while it was still daylight and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages Then he dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open. Then King Pastanini went to them and asked, "Venerable sirs, where is he living now? The Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. We want to see the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened." "That is his dwelling, great king, with the closed door. Go up to it quietly, without hurrying, enter the porch, clear your throat, and tap on the panel. The Blessed One will open the door for you." King Pastanini handed over his sword and turban to Digha-Karayana then and there. Then Digha-Karayana thought, "So, the king is going to secret session now, and I have to wait here alone now." And it has to do with some political intrigue that he was, in collusion with the king's son to try to usurp powers from King Pastanini. Okay? Without hurrying, King Pastanini went quietly to the dwelling with a closed door. He entered the porch, cleared his throat, and tapped on the panel. The Blessed One opened the door. Then King Pastanini entered the dwelling, prostrating himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet. He covered the Blessed One's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands, pronouncing his name. "I am King Pastanini of Kosala, Venerable Sir. I am King Pastanini of Kosala, Venerable Sir. But great king, what reason do you see for doing such supreme honor to this body and for showing such friendship?" It's interesting that for the Buddha even referred, you know, he always referred to himself like, you know, in terms of five khandhas. He doesn't say, you know, in terms of I or mine or myself. He says, you know, what reason do you think, you know, for doing such supreme honor to this body, you know, this kind of physical mass of his, and not really to, you know, to me or anything. So it's interesting, he just referred to that, I thought. Anyway, the guy said, "Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way." Now, Venerable Sir, I see some recluses and Brahmins leading a limited holy life for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or 40 years. And then on a later occasion, I see them well-groomed, well-anointed, with trimmed hair and beards, enjoying themselves provided and endowed with the five courses of sensual pleasure. But here I see bhikkhus leading the perfect and pure life, holy life, as long as life and breath last. Indeed, I do not see any other holy life elsewhere as perfect and as pure as this. This is why, Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way. So what it seems is that basically it's a generalization, because, you know, obviously during the Buddha's time, there were monks who disrobed before, you know, they died and fell away from the holy life. Right? But I think in general, he was saying that, you know, in terms of religious teachings and different sects, that in the Buddha dispensation, most of the monks he sees, you know, live a full and contented life as a monk. And also it points to kind of, you know, why people are doing it, like the externals, the results of being a monk. Obviously, if you're happy and content with what you're doing, then you'll be doing it for a long, long time. It's only if you find discontent and you're not happy in what you're doing, then the lay life will draw you back there, right? And also, kind of the last three lines where he repeats it over and over again, the refrains, the Blessed One is full, now how he infers according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One, that the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way. And this just refers to the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. You know, first, you know, in terms of his faith and his gratitude, and in terms of respect. The Buddha is a person who discovered, you know, the truth, you know, the way things are. And the Dhamma is the truth. And also the Buddha, he says, you know, the Buddha also refers to himself. You know, if you've seen the Dhamma, then you see the Buddha. If you've seen the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. So he's implying that obviously the Buddha is the Dhamma. All his actions, all his thoughts are always in line with the truth, in line with the way things are. You know, he actually walks the talks. He doesn't talk the talks, you know. His life is everything is open. There's nothing he does in secret that's different from what he would talk or how he acts in public or in secret. It's the same. Right? The Buddha is the first person to discover the truth. And also the great thing about the Sangha is that to start off with, the Buddha is a human being who discovered this kind of great truth, and then he taught it to other members, to other human beings who also, through their own efforts, you know, realized these truths. So the Buddha was the first person to discover it, and everybody else that followed him also can realize the same truth. And it has great implications for all of us, because it also implies that, you know, normal people like you or I, you know, we have enough faith, enough respect, and of dedication, we can also walk this path and realize for ourselves the truth that the Buddha realized 2,600 years ago. You know, this is a religion of kind of our own salvations. It doesn't rely on, you know, a God, a superhuman being that you have to put faith in. Only he can know the truth, and all we can do is believe what he says. No, faith in the Buddhism is more rational. It also involves a lot of discernment, involves a lot of wisdom. Faith in Buddhism is closer to our reaction or how we use kind of the city map. You know, like the neighborhood that we lived in, this map is very accurate. It shows, you know, the way. It shows all the number of the houses, the different structures around our neighborhood. And sometimes even if we live in a city, let's say, it's very flat. And this map is very accurate. It shows all the things that should be there. It's all in the map. But then further along the map, there's all these kind of funny structures. There's deserts, and maybe there's oceans, there's water. And if you've never left your neighborhood, you don't know what water is because you kind of, you know, you stayed on land all the time. But because the map is so accurate in your city or your neighborhood, and then even if it describes strange kind of landmasses, strange structures, you still have a lot of faith that is true because the little area that you know, the map is very accurate. And it's the same in terms of our practice. We, you know, have faith in the Buddha's teaching. We practice letting go. We practice generosity. And we see that, you know, we are, and also we practice mindfulness and meditation. And we see that our life is more peaceful, that the more we let go, the more simple our lives are, the more happier we are, and, you know, and the more things we let go, the, you know, yeah, generally we practice generosity and we feel happy. So what little kind of truth that we realize, it points to, okay, yeah, maybe we haven't achieved all the four jhanas, maybe we haven't achieved the Magapala yet. We don't quite know what, you know, what the minds of arhants is like, or what kind of, you know, we know sometimes we're down on ourselves. We said, you know, I have so much kind of greed, so much anger, I'll never be enlightened. Sometimes those doubts comes up. But that's where, you know, faith can push you along. Because you realize that, you know, with the little letting go we have, we experience some happiness. And then, so the more we let go, the happier we are. And you see that, you know, ultimately, we can let go of everything. Like Ajahn Chah said, you let go a little bit, you experience a little happiness. You let it go a lot, you experience a lot of happiness. And if you let go of everything, then you're always happy. You experience complete happiness. And that's where faith, and that's where the kind of stimuli in the map comes in. But we don't quite know what these kind of exalted states are like. But we still have faith, because the peace that we have experienced, you know, leads us. It feels good. It feels right. We know we're heading the right way. Right? Okay? So that's where, you know, the three ties together. The Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. If you have respect for one, it all goes for all three. Okay. Any questions or comments? Okay, it's pretty straightforward. No strange terms. Okay. Okay, so that's the first quality why King Pasandi was paying respect to the Buddha, because the fact that, you know, monks, you know, stay in the holy life for a long, long time. This is generalization, obviously. You probably know our monastery is going on a bit of a slump, but but things come and they go. Okay, again, Venerable Sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders. mother's quarrels with child, and child with mother, father with child, and child with father, and so on, so on, so on. But here I see bhikkhus living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. I do not see any other assembly elsewhere with such concord. This too, venerable sir, is why I inferred according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way. And here implies, you see, that, you know, harmony in the, also in the Buddhist dispensation is paramount. Harmony of the group. When he kind of made up the discipline in for the monks, he always put harmony above everything else. He said, even if the monk, you know, does something wrong, and you, before you admonish him, you should think, you know, of a few kind of criteria before you go and you admonish this monk. One, more than the important one, is that whether it be beneficial for him, right? First is whether it's truth, whether you have your facts straight, whether, you know, you see him doing what he did, and for the right reason. Let's say you see the monk, one monk, I see a monk, you know, at night or something in the kitchen. He goes and it looks like, you know, he's taking some food, right? And then that is against the monk's kind of discipline. The first thing before I admonish him is I have to certify to make sure whether what I'm seeing is true, whether it's the right monk, you know, good enough light to see whether he's taking food and whether, you know, whether there's any reasons that he should be taking food. Maybe sometime he left something in the kitchen and it's not really food. It's something else that he forgot and he picked it up. Right? So first I have to make sure I asked him, was that food that I see you taking at night the other night? So first you have to make sure that you have the truth. Okay? And two, secondly, is that you have to make sure that the thing that you admonish him for will be beneficial for him. That whether he's in the right state of mind, whether he will gain and benefit from it. And three, whether it's, you know, harmonious. And the Buddha says, if it's not beneficial for him, do not say it. Do not admonish him for it. And also, if it causes, you know, disharmony in the Sangha, also do not bring that up. He put the Sangha above everything. Whether it's true or not, it's irrelevant, he said. Because I think with deep wisdom, he realized that unless, you know, the external, the coarser aspect of the monk's life, it's in harmony. It's very difficult to have a peaceful mind. It's very difficult to have peaceful states. As most of you are meditators, know that, you know, if you just have kind of a run-in with somebody, things aren't going well, and you kind of just have an argument with somebody, it's very difficult to sit and close your eye and focus your optimal meditation. So, you know, harmony on the external level is very, very important in the monk's life. And that's why it is also increases the faith of the general public. You know, people go to the monastery to be inspired. People go to the monastery, you know, to see people getting along. They see plenty of people getting, you know, angry with each other in the world. They see plenty of people getting into fights and arguments. So when people go to the monastery, obviously, you know, they have a certain expectations of monks, you know, living in harmony and you know, with looking at each other with kindly eyes and forgiving. But also, there also is the other side of obviously the spectrum, that there is truth. Obviously, monks, there's 20 or 30 of us at a time in the monastery, and we're not arahants, right? So there are times, and you know, and we also are very different individuals, different views and opinions, and different kind of inclinations. So there are times when, you know, there is some friction. Because we do live very closely to each other. So we're not saying that, you know, we're all kind of grinning ear, you know, ear to ear all the time and saying, you know, whistling, you know, all the time because we're happy. But it also implies that, yes, there are differences and sometimes we get into an argument. But obviously, the long-term goal of living in the monastery is always pointing to harmony. Always points towards, you know, letting go. So whatever the, you know, whatever the issue is, you know, we're taught. Or we're, you know, kind of encouraged to, you know, to let them go, you know, for the sake of harmony. And also, if you understand meditation, you have a feeling for peace, you know that it doesn't matter what happened externally. It doesn't matter what, you know, if the monk you're fighting with is right or wrong. Ultimately, if you have an argument with this person, and you drag on this grudge and this, you know, vengefulness, is going to affect, one, first of all, your meditation, and two, something that you consider when you live in a group. It also affects all the people around it. Everybody, oh, you know, with the group, at least with kind of the monk sangha anyway, everybody knows everything about everybody. A lot of times it's not explicit, but it's kind of a general feeling. You can feel whether, you know, these two monks aren't getting along, and you walk into a room and it's very unpleasant because you're in the middle of some fight or something. So you know that you have an argument and you have some kind of dispute with somebody else. It first of all affects yourself, so your practice is down to two. And then, if you're sensitive, you look around, you're affecting the whole sangha around you. So we're always taught to, yeah, just settle the differences. Always practice forgiveness. And we have a forgiveness ceremony that we do quite often. There's many kind of anecdotes from Ajahn Chah's days that, and also Ajahn Brahm talks about it a lot. That it doesn't matter what happened. If you get into argument, you're both wrong. Wrong from the standpoint of the Dhamma. Wrong because you've lost it. Wrong because, you know, you're wrapping a sense of self around, you know, what's happened, you know, in the past. Wrong because you're not in the present moment. Wrong because you've forgotten how to forgive. Wrong because you're putting your own feelings and emotions ahead of the group, ahead of the whole sangha. And he always says, youngest monk, you apologize. Doesn't matter what the senior monk said. So it's very nice, the more senior you get. You can never be wrong. Especially when Ajahn goes away. No. But it also, it takes kind of the sting of personality out of it. That, you know, senior, so you, it also encourages respect for seniority. Always giving people the benefit of the doubt. I don't always agree with, you know, Ajahn Bamali does, but yeah, he's a senior one, so okay, do the way he does. And also, in the long term, it makes it easy. I don't have to think. It's not really up to me. That way you don't have to worry, you know, why should I do this, do that? Okay. If he says to do that, let him have it. It's actually, in the long run, more simple. It's also helping, encouraging the practice of letting go. Because the monastery is not about, it's not a real business. You know, we don't have to be efficient. We don't have, you know, the monastery, we don't have to operate on kind of, you know, lay world principle of getting things on time. Things are never on time. So that you have to give up as soon as you get there. And, you know, things sometimes, you know, I'm managing our resources from my point of view anyway. Sometimes it can be better efficiently kind of, you know, distributed. But after a while you said, you know, it's a lot of trouble kind of always having to put your two cents in. You know, sometimes if Ajahn asks, okay, I tell him. If he takes up my advice, good. If he doesn't, okay, I'm not the abbot. Ajahn has to live there. I can go anytime I want. So it also, it makes me at peace. Allows me to go back to my kuti and just, you know, drop things and not worry about them. So I think, you know, all these practices of letting go is pointing inwards. Always pointing, you know, to peaceful states of mind. Always pointing more, you know, towards more happiness. The more, you know, the more you let go, the happier you are. Right? And that's where the Dhamma comes in. Okay. Okay, where are we? Okay, so he's talking about harmony, and then next on 12, paragraph 12. Again, Venerable Sir, I have walked in wonder from park to park, from garden to garden. Here I've seen some recluses and Brahmins who are lean, wretched, unsightly, jaundiced, with veins standing out on their limbs, such that people would not want to look at them again. I have thought, surely these venerable ones are leading the holy life in discontent, or they have done some evil deed that are and are concealing it. So lean and wretched are they, such that people would not want to look at them again. And I went up to them and asked, why are you venerable ones so lean and wretched, such that people would not want to look at you again? Their reply was, it is our family sickness, great king. I didn't really get what this meant. So I call up our Pali expert, Ajahn Brahmali, and he checked the Pali, and that's what it means, just a family sickness. And the only thing we can deduce from this is that I guess they're too embarrassed to kind of admit that, you know, the holy life they're leading is not bringing them contentment. And the expression you see about, you know, being lean and wretched and with your veins standing out, it's the standard kind of description of a physical kind of manifestation of an unhappy mind state. when they talk about monk being unhappy, they go on through the same passages. He's lean, wretched, unsightly looking. And then, you know, he goes to the Buddha and asks, he says, I want to disrobe. So it's also kind of a stock description of, you know, monks who are not, you know, who are living the life discontent. Okay? So that's the only thing I can think of, that maybe it's just kind of a physical symptom of an internal state. But here I see Bhikkhu smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as the wild deer's. I have thought, surely these venerable ones perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the blessed one's dispensation. Since they abide thus smiling and cheerful, with a mind as aloof as the wild deer's. This too, venerable sir, is what I infer according to Dhamma about the blessed one. The blessed one is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the blessed one, and the Sangha of the blessed one's disciples practicing the good way. Again, also, this is a generalization. We're not, like I said, super happy, clappy, happy-go-lucky all the time in the monastery, right? There are, I mean, this is a general trend. And also, you can see, although sometimes, you know, not everybody's super happy, but if you've seen the person where they started, usually you do see trends with younger monks. The longer they've been in the monastery, they are, and also if they're genuine in working with their own defilements, you see there is improvement. Obviously, everybody had their own starting points. Some have very rough childhood, so he's more coarse. But eventually, because we live with each other, we're grinding each other all the time, all the rubbing of friction, there is a positive benefit, you know, and that we're grinding away the coarser, you know, kind of tendencies in our mind. And that's also where the training comes in. So generally, if you've seen them, yeah, there is a general trend towards more peacefulness, more kindness over the years, right? And also, it also implies that, yeah, you know, being a monk, people only do what they do because they're getting something out of it. They stay as a monk a long time because it makes them happy, or they're getting happier and happier. And if you're happy and content with what you're doing, you don't want to change. It's just obvious. And it's the same, you know, with anything. If you enjoy to do what you're doing, then you're not, you know, you're likely to do it for a long, long time. Okay? So that's also kind of something we can glean from the sutta. You know, whatever we do, whatever situation we're at, you know, find some enjoyment, and then we're likely to stay there longer. Always look for the bright side. Always look for, you know, the happiness or the enjoyment. Okay, this one, I guess. On paragraph 13, again, venerable sir, being a head anointed noble king, I'm able to have executed those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to exile those who should be exiled. Yet I'm sitting in council. They break in and interrupt me. Though I say, gentlemen, do not break in and interrupt me when I'm sitting in council. Wait till the end of my speech. Still, they break in and interrupt me. But here I see an assembly of several hundred followers, and there is not even a sound of a disciple of the Blessed One coughing or clearing his throat. Once the Blessed One was teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there a disciple of his cleared his throat. Thereupon one of his companions in the holy life nudged him with his knees to indicate, "Be quiet, venerable sir, make no noise. The Blessed One, the teacher, is teaching us the Dhamma." I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, how an assembly can be so well disciplined without force or weapon. Indeed, I do not see any other assembly elsewhere so well disciplined. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha, the Blessed One's disciple, is practicing the good way. This, you can see how kind of spiritual qualities, like faith, gratitude, and respect. These qualities are subtle and also sometimes very hard to develop, you know, a strong foundation. They take a long time to develop, allowing people to kind of act out of faith, allowing people to do what they want to do. you know, not controlling, not out of fear or force. So faith, gratitude, and kind of respect, it takes, you know, those are qualities that are hard to come by. It takes a long time to develop. But once the foundation is set, then in the long term, these qualities are more powerful than the quick short-term fix of force and fear. And that's why sometimes you can see how, you know, the monk sangha is set up, where really, you know, it's a system of honor. You're allowed to do whatever you want to do. In terms of, you know, we don't have people looking after you, especially in the monastery. You're not told off very often, or not hardly at all by anybody. Ajahn, you know, kind of always encourage people to, you know, and in the forest tradition, to always look at others only 5% of the time and look at yourself 95% of the time. So allowing people to kind of work with their own defilements in the mind, allowing people their own time and space, you know, to be more peaceful and to do things that, you know, that kind of let faith arises. And faith can only arise when you live with a person a long, long time. You know, everybody can get up here and give very good speeches and good talks. And sometimes, you know, spiritual teachers can be quite inspiring in a crowd. But it's only through living with them for a long, long time, through looking at them, to see how they react to adversity, you know, adversities, to see how they react when they're being praised, and when they're being blamed, that we really know, you know, how deep the spiritual teachings that they're teaching have penetrated, you know, to themselves. And that's why it takes a long time, you know, especially for Westerners, or Western educated people, to have faith arises, because our conditioning is that, you know, everybody's equal here. I'm equal, you know, you got two hands and two legs, and, you know, why should I be, you know, doing your washing for you? Why should I massage your feet? You've got, you know, you get your own stuff. We're all equal in that sense. And sometimes it leads to a lack of faith, a lack of respect for qualities, for people that are, you know, more spiritually developed than we are. That's why I find that the act of bowing is very crucial. Respect is very crucial in any spiritual path. You know, we think we're equal, we think we're the same. They were unlikely to be, you know, to listen to what another person has to say. We're all equal, then why should I listen to what you say? I have the same, you know, I have views and opinions, you have views and opinions. What makes yours so right? Right? But it's only through respect, through worship, through honoring another person, saying, okay, I have something to learn. You know, there's something I can learn from you here. And then, okay, maybe I don't know for sure, but okay, I give you the benefit of the doubt that because you're being in the monks for a longer time, maybe you know more things than I have. So I'm going to not take my, you know, views and opinions to be true. I'm going to follow what you say out of faith and see what happens. So faith allows us to kind of learn more, to kind of, you know, we're like Ajahn Chah said, we're not a full cup. If you're full of it, full of yourself, full of views and opinions, it's very hard to reflect and to look around and to learn more things. So, you know, being an empty cup allows you to have other things to pour into, to allow wisdom to arise because of the emptiness. Okay. Yes. That's a good point, and as to bring it up. And also respect has many different levels along the path, right? In the beginning, it's more like, okay, almost kind of belief or kind of blind belief. Okay, yeah, I don't know for sure, but you look like you know what you're doing, so I'm going to give you respect. But also it brings some discernment. You have to always look and always kind of question and to find out whether this person is doing what he does. But no, respect has to be earned in the sense that whoever puts on the robe has, you know, to behave in line with what he said, what he teaches to begin with, right? So it has to be heard in that sense. And also, respect and faith. When you really respect and faith someone, it's deeper than bowing. Bowing is just to start, to open things up. It's a physical kind of act to say, okay, I'm physically putting myself lower than you are, that way I can learn. And then it doesn't stop there. It doesn't mean that everything that person say is true. But you begin to, out of faith, out of respect, you begin to contemplate. You begin to put these teachings into practice in your own kind of, in your own practice to see whether it's working. Right? And then that's where a lot of faith and respect arises. And that's where you know whether the practitioner has gained anything from the practice, how much faith and how much respect they show to the teacher. True respect. Obviously, you know, like the Buddha said when he was lying on his deathbed, yes, you can honor me with flowers and incense and, you know, and with, you know, different gifts or whatever, but the supreme way, the best way for you to really honor and respect me is to put what I teach into practice, to realize my teaching for yourself, to become enlightened. That's how true respect, that's the highest form of faith and respect and homage you can do to the teacher, to really put what he said into practice for yourself. And then when you realize, you know, peace in your own mind, then lots of faith and respect arises naturally. You don't have to kind of convince yourself, okay, yeah, he's given me so much and I should be more faithful and should more respect, but I'm still angry with what he said. Yeah, you don't have, it's not that internal struggle all the time, or not internal struggle, you know, internal questioning, internal doubt. Yeah, he's saying this, but I'm not sure what exactly he's doing, his kriti. You know, if you realize and you've kind of attained some peace of mind through the practice of his teaching, then you can see enormous faith arises. And that's why you can see when it says like the Sotapanna, the stream enterer, the one who realized the first stage of enlightenment, he has unshakable faith in the Buddha. Because he's realized already for himself for sure, he's safe, there's no doubt anymore, because he's seen the truth. He may not realize the truth, but he's seen the truth, he's seen what Nibbana is like. So that's why his faith is unshakable. Before then, there's different degrees, right? And also, like I said, and that's why Buddhism moving to the West has a lot of, you know, good consequences. One is that, you know, the faith is not so kind of blind in that sense. People always question before they take everything on. And that's what true respect is, it should be. Dhamma teaching is not something, you know, in the books and something you put on the shelf and then you dust it once a year. No, those books and those teachings and the sutras are meant to be read, are meant to be contemplated, are meant for you to kind of put into practice every day. And that's where true respect comes from. It's not, you know, yeah, bowing, crawling around on your feet. Yeah, that's one form. But like I say, practicing the teaching is the supreme homage you can do to your teacher. Okay? Does that answer your question? No? Uh-huh. It's true. It's very tricky because one, we are enjoying many, many supports and supplies and lots of respect and faith that lay people show to, you know, us young monks. And obviously, you have to be somewhat circumspective, somewhat reflective to know that obviously when they come and they grovel in front of me and they crawl around, it's not really me that they're paying respect to. It's out of Ajahn Brahm's barmy because of all the teachings that he's taught that these people are showing the monks so much respect. But sometimes you're not so reflective and you lose your mind because you do take the sense that, oh, they're bound to me. They think I'm great. I must be great. And then you begin to start to take things for granted. You know, whatever you say, whatever you hint, if it doesn't, they don't come running with it, you become very disappointed. But then again, you know, it's not irreversible because you can see that the suffering arises. If you're too conceited, things will happen to kind of, obviously, to chip away from such conceit. But also, it's true, sometimes young monks do have to be careful. And that's why Ajahn Brahm usually, he has most of the lay interactions. He talks to lay people and kind of shelter the young monks away from too much interaction. Because it does go through the head. Because you do have a lot of people who do have a lot of faith and they come to the monastery and they think all the monks are hitting fourth jhanas right away and we all must be enlightened. You know, Ajahn Brahm is, you know, this far down. Second monk must be just a little bit behind him and everybody else just behind him. And it's, you know, unfortunately, not quite that easy and not, you know, close to reality. You know, I think a few years ago when I first came, one of the regular visitors, you know, he pointed the first five monks and said, oh, those five monks, they all have psychic powers. And that's not true. But it just seems like, you know, a lot of them is projection. We want, you know, monks to be good. And also we're looking for, you know, it's also a sense of self in there. If my teacher is the arhat, then I must be great because I picked the right one. Right? If my teacher is just, you know, first, you know, stream entered, and oh no, I should find one that's more attained. So a lot of his sense of self comes from that, those projections as well, right? So, but also, just to know that putting on the robes hasn't changed anything inside. For most of us, except Ajahn Brahm, we're just really just lay people in robes in that sense, because we haven't seen the Dhamma yet. But they're still worthy of respect on another aspect, in the sense that at least the monks are have enough faith and respect and confidence in the path to renounce the world and to keep the precepts and to live in the Sangha under the teacher. So there's some renunciation, and you also have to give them the benefit of the doubt that everybody is working to eliminate their own defilements as fast as he or she can, right? That, we don't know what's happening inside. You just have to, you know, okay, yeah, he's looking kind of funny, he's looking kind of angry, but you don't know where their starting point is, and you don't know what factors, what things they're going through that, you know, to see the end results. So I think generally, respect is sometimes, it's going to be overdone, but also, for the monks and the nuns, you know, well-deserved in the sense that at least they're trying. At least they're inclining towards peace, right? And also, when lay people pay respect to the Sangha, it's not really, I think, in the ultimate sense, this physical being here. I think, you know, the way I see it is, the people paying respect to that aspect within themselves of the renunciation, the paying to the ideal that one day, you know, I can too become a monk. I'm paying respect and homage, this idea of renunciation, this idea of, you know, working to kind of purify my own mind, you know, body and speech. And that, if you pay respect to that, and you pay homage to that, then the mind inclines towards that. And then you yourself would also incline towards, you know, purifying your own mind, purifying your own body and speech. Yeah. Sure. Okay. But it's true, we are, more than well supported on the monastery in terms of, you know, material stuff and even in terms of the immaterial stuff. So that's why it's good that for young monks sometimes to go Bindabad or to go to different monasteries, to go new monasteries where, you know, that you haven't had the benefit of 20 years of hard work of teachings by Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Jnana, or Ajahn Jagrath, you know. Because here, you know, they've been around for 20 years teaching, you know, lots and lots of teaching, and they build up a certain foundation already. And yes, we've got the good karma to inherit this. But also, in that sense, it's also, obviously, a responsibility to live up to a certain expectation. Right. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Okay, so he's talking about how he's the powerful king, but yet people still interrupt him. So that's why you see the fear and force only goes so far, and it's only very short term. But in long term, it's, you know, faith, gratitude, and respect. Okay. Okay, and this is going on to paragraph 14. Again, venerable sir, I have seen certain learned nobles who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, as sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. They wander about as they were demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. When they hear the reckless goldsmith will visit such and such a village or town, they formulate a question thus. We will go to the reckless goldsmith and ask him this question. If he is asked like this, he will answer like this. And so we will refute his doctrine in this way. And if he is asked like that, he will answer like that. And so, we will refute his doctrine in that way. They hear the reckless Gotama has come to visit such and such a village or town. They go to the Blessed One, and the Blessed One instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages them with a talk on the Dhamma. And after they've been instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged by the Blessed One with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question. So how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they become his disciples. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha, the Blessed One's disciples, practicing the good way. This for me, I think it just means, you know, the power of truth. If you have truth already in your hand, you know, it's something you can always rely on. And all this kind of intellectual razzle-dazzle, this intellectual kind of, playing with concepts, it really, at the end of the day, cannot chip away the truth that you discover. If you realize the truth, you don't have to be very learned. Ajahn Chah had a 4-year education, and he can really, out-talk most of people who have PhDs and very learned scholars from Bangkok or from other countries. So, realization of the truth is paramount. Once you have the truth inside you, it gives you confidence, and it gives you the clarity to really cut away any confusion or doubt that people may throw up. Right? And he goes on about a certain learned Brahmins and a certain learned householders. And then he goes on, again, Venerable Sir, I have seen certain learned recluses. They do not so much as ask him the question, so how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they ask the Blessed One to allow them to go forth from the home life into homelessness, and he gives them the going forth. Not long after they have thus gone forth, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. They say thus, we were nearly lost, we were nearly perished, for formerly we claimed that we were recluses, though we were not really recluses. We claimed that we were Brahmins, though we were not really Brahmins. We claimed that we were Arhants, though we were not really Arhants. But now we are recluses, now we are Brahmins, now we are Arhants. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way. And this, like I said, sometimes in this age of multi-faith gatherings and in this global village, and then we think, all religions are the same. And that, you can become enlightened, and, Buddhism is just one path of many. And it's kind of nice and warm and fuzzy and to think that way, but it's clearly not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, obviously, in the beginning, obviously there are very similar traits. You can't go wrong with generosity, you can't go wrong with harmlessness, and you cannot go wrong with, harmony. But those are just starting the path. But as you go further and further, and you go see the deeper wisdom, those deeper wisdoms are not available to anyone outside of the Eightfold Path. You have to have the meditation to see clearly the deep-seated delusion that we all carry around, the delusion of I, mine, and a self in here, the delusion of, suffering is happiness, the delusion of... what are the other four delusions? What's suffering is happiness, that there's a self in here, and what is impermanent is permanent, right? And it's only deep meditation through the stillness of mind and through correct wisdom, right view, that we can, go through this, that we can see the truth. So that's why, like I said, that's why you see that this is a precious path. Something that we can, we should put effort in developing. That we also know that, within this, the vehicle is, it's good enough to take us to the end of the path. And also we have the good karma to, discover this teaching. And that not to discard it and go looking to, outside of the Buddhist dispensation for the alternative. Right? People agree? Disagree? Too fundamentalist? We are fundamentalists, but the stress is on fun. And this is my favorite one. Again, Venerable Sir, Isidati and Purana, my two inspectors, eat my food and use my carriages. I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. Yet, in spite of this, they are less respectful towards me than they are towards the Blessed One. Once I had gone out leading an army and was testing these inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, I happened to put them up in very cramped quarters. Then these two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, after spending much of the night in talking the Dhamma, lay down with their heads in the direction where they had learned that the Blessed One was staying, and with their feet towards me. I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous. These two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, eat my food, use my carriages, and I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. Yet, in spite of this, they are less respectful towards me than they are towards the Blessed One. Surely these good people perceive successful states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation. This too, Venerable Sir, is what I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha, the Blessed One's disciples, practicing the good way. See, this is a bit, I was told by another monk, that it's a bit over the top with this feet thing. But a lot of times you see that Westerners or people from outside the Thai tradition always accuse the Thai tradition of too many rites and ritual and, you know, adding too much to the Buddha's teaching and then being oversensitive to certain kind of rituals and kind of the external forms of Buddhism, of, you know, the feet pointing. They get very sensitive with feet and they think, okay, it must be a Thai cultural addition. But no, I mean, this is one clear place in the Sutta that, you know, even for the Buddha at the time, he mentioned that, you know, pointy feet is a kind of a sign of disrespect. And also in another place in the discipline, there was a rule on the regarding drinking alcohol. And as you may or may not know, the Buddha only pronounced the rules, instilled the rules, only if there was a reason for it. So previously to this, you know, monks could drink alcohol and all that stuff. Because not that they could drink alcohol, but he thought it was obvious that you shouldn't be drunk, that he'd even, you know, kind of made up a rules against it. So there was no rule against taking alcoholic drinks before this. But then after this, he instilled the rules. And the story to this rule of not taking alcoholic drink that can dull the mind or kind of, so that you can lose your mindfulness is because of this. There was this monk with great psychic powers. He was a very good monk and, good meditation, had deep meditation. He had a lot of psychic powers. And he was going to a cave to meditate, to practice. As with most story, it has a mythic aspect to it. Okay, so he's, you know, good monk, wanting to meditate in a cave. But unfortunately, in that cave, there's already this snake, but they're nagas, this kind of magical snake that has magical powers. But sometimes they're, what do you call that? They're Buddhist friendly, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're very conceited because of their magical power. So this magical naga, magical snake, thought, okay, he was kind of the ruler of this cave, and then here comes this monk. And he didn't want the monk to go in. And he would usually bite and chase the villagers away, or he would spit smoke and fire at people to chase them away. So the villagers warned him not to go. Anyway, he went ahead. And of course they had this big psychic, you know, knockout fight. He blew fire, the monk blew fire back, he blew smoke, the monk blew smoke back. Anyway, the monk was more powerful and subdued this powerful naga. So the villager was, you know, mightily impressed. They saw this kind of big boxing match up in the air or something, I suppose. And they said, wow, Venerable, you're mighty and powerful. We want to, you know, give you things to out of faith and to honor you. And what should we give? But unfortunately, he already gone back to his hut. So they asked another monk, a group of monks, and they were called a group of six, mostly scallywag monks, who weren't keeping the rules and who were, you know, doing many, many silly things. So what they advised, they weren't very good monks, so they advised this man was, you know, what's hard to for him to get? You know, he can get food and robes. That's quite easy. That's easy to come by. You know what's hard for this monk to get? It's alcohol. Give him strong drinks. That's very hard for monks to get. Because obviously, for good reason, monks aren't, really supposed to drink it. So he's pretty simple-minded. The villagers are pretty simple-minded. So that's what they give him the next day when this monk went on alms round. Drinks, fermented drinks. So the monk, because there's no rules, I guess they didn't say whether he attained any stages of enlightenment. But anyway, for some reason or other, just very naive, I guess, he started drinking it. one after the other. And after maybe about a few, you know, several drinks, he became very drunk. And he started, babbling and just lying in the road. And then when the Buddha came by, you know, to talk to him, you know, monk turned him around to that way his head was facing towards the Buddha, talk to the Buddha. But then because he was so drunk, he had no mindfulness, he turned around and kept pointing his feet at the Buddha. And the Buddha, you know, made this comment. He says, before, this monk was a mighty monk. You know, he could conquer this big kind of snake. And now, only after a few drinks, you know, he's babbling away and he's pointing his feet towards me, you know. Where is his mighty power? Where's his mindfulness now? All because of the drink. And that's why he made the rules that, okay, drinking fermented drink is, I guess, the vinaya. But the point of the story is not about the kind of the rules about the drinks, but it's about the fact that, you know, the feet pointing is also was derived back in the time of the Buddha because of Indian cultures. There's just not the kind of the Thai thing that was added later on because of the superstition or something, right? So it's actually backed up by kind of text in the suttas. Right. Okay, again, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One is a noble, and I'm a noble. The Blessed One is a Kosalan, and I'm a Kosalan. The Blessed One is 80 years old, and I'm 80 years old. Since that is so, I think it proper to do supreme honor to the Blessed One and just show such friendship. And then he does the usual thing. Okay, now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Buddha says, now is the time, great king, to do as you think fit. Then King Prasanna of Kosala rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then soon after he had left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, before rising from his seat and departing, this King Prasanna the utter monuments to the Dhamma. Learn the monuments to the Dhamma, bhikkhus. Master the monuments to the Dhamma. Remember the monuments to the Dhamma. The monuments to the Dhamma are beneficial bhikkhus, and they belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. And this is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus was satisfying and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So what do you think the monuments to the Dhammas were? Because that was the only thing that was said towards the end. He didn't say, you know, during the discourse, you know, what it actually was. It's only inferred. You know, is monuments to the Dhamma kind of big Buddha statues of gold, solid gold Buddha statues that, you know, that people build in different countries? Or is monuments to the Dhamma, you know, the big kind of marble palaces and gold palaces, big great monasteries with chandeliers that also people build in different countries, you know? No, monuments to the Dhamma is the qualities of mind and the qualities of faith, of respect, of gratitude, right? Of harmony, of happiness. Those are the true, you know, kind of monuments to the Dhamma. And also, I think when, also just by King, you know, Prasanna's kind of act of such gratitude to the Buddha, you can see, obviously he himself is, you know, getting a lot of benefit from it. So that's why so much faith arises for him, so much, you know, kind of respect and gratitude arises, because he himself is realizing some of the peace and happiness from it. So this, like I said, it's something for us to also look and reflect on within ourselves. And you'll notice, it's true. If you had a good meditation, you have so much gratitude. I have so much gratitude for Ashram. I just want to run and kind of, you know, wash his feet or something. He doesn't like it, so I would never do that. But it's something you want to do. You just want to do something to help out. And that because you realize and you touch any peace, it's a natural. Faith arises natural, and gratitude and respect is natural. But also just to know that it's a gradual path. You know, faith, these are kind of very subtle qualities of mind, something that we can't force ourselves. That's something we have to feel as we go along. And something we can't fake. People know when you truly respect them or truly know when you're just BSing them, obviously. Right? But they come naturally, and they come, you know, step by step. And that's something that each and every one of us, we can develop gradually on our path. Okay? Any further questions or comments? That's right, that's right. Also, it's very beautiful quality to see other people, especially obviously for monks, we can see many lay people, and you just see some people have so much faith and so much gratitude arising, and you just by inference, okay, yeah, you know, and it must be very, very peaceful. If it's genuine, you know, gratitude and genuine kind of respect. Yeah. And also for yourself as well. It's just a natural, it's very, also a very enjoyable kind of sensation. And, oh yeah, also to close off with, even the Buddha himself, after he became enlightened, in Bodhgaya, and he was, you know, so blissed out that he actually just stood staring at the Bodhi tree, not moving for 7 days, okay? And after 7 days, he had this thought, and it's very interesting for the Buddha to have this thought. He said, to dwell without respect is suffering. To not have anything to worship and honor is suffering. Even for the Buddha, fully enlightened, discovered the path by himself, he thought that was suffering. So he looked around. He said, is there any ascetic or recluses that has, you know, that has purity equal to mine or more? And obviously the Buddha sees things as they are. He's not kind of falsely modest or something. You see, he looked around with psychic power and looked at different beings. And, you know, the truth was there were no one around who was purity, was higher than he was, who was more pure in mind than he was. So he goes, okay, was there any beings around whose kind of stillness is deeper than he is? He looks around, no. Is there anybody around whose wisdom is sharper and more penetrating than mine? No, there's nobody around. So obviously he said, okay, I cannot kind of put my head towards someone who's obviously not more pure in terms of, you know, harmlessness and restraint, and who's not as deep meditation as I have, and deep wisdom. But he said, he kept reflecting backwards and forth, okay, it's suffering not to have anybody to worship, to pay homage to respect. But you don't want to, you know, respect out of kind of false modesty either, somebody who is not attained, right? So he looked and he thought about it and said, ah, what I do is dwell, paying homage, revering this Dhamma of mine. I'll pay respect to this Dhamma, this truth. And that's what I want to pay respect to. Pay respect, and also he paid, obviously of homage for him, was his Bodhi tree, because he sat underneath it and allowed him shade. So I'll pay homage also to the Bodhi tree. And then, one of the great god Brahma came and said, that is so, the Buddha. It's the same with Buddhists of the past. They also pay homage to the Dhamma and also the Bodhi tree or the different trees that they sat under. So it's interesting. Yeah, the Buddha himself, obviously he wasn't being falsely modest and says, okay, you know, I'll just pay homage to anybody, anything because I'm supposed to be humble. No, he said, okay, yeah, there are things worthy of respect. But also the quality of respect, the quality of homage itself, the quality of the fact of opening your mind to something higher than yourself is happiness. It's not suffering, it's happiness. And that's an interesting thing, because we always think, oh, God, why do I have to bow to this guy? You know, he's only ordained 2 months before I have. And all this bowing is a bit over the top, isn't it? But, you know, not to have respect is suffering. So I thought it was interesting. Buddha himself said it. Yeah. To dwell without respect is suffering. Okay. And that's what I'm going to close it with. Yeah. Kosalan, I think he's a Kathian, but I think he must be closer on his mother's side. Yeah, that's why the mother's side. Yeah, yeah. Any questions or comments? Okay. Maybe we'll pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadeni Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Asavaka Sangho Sangham Namah.